It is a pleasure and honor to welcome you to the annual Revitzins Conference of the Task Force on Children and Families at Risk. I'm Judy Steinig, Revitzin of the Young Israel of Bayside in Queens, and Director of Programming of National Council of Young Israel, a proud member of the Task Force, which is a 40-member agency coalition of mental health and social service agencies. This annual Task Force Conference is a wonderful way for Revitzins to socialize, network, discuss, and learn about various topics that can only be addressed at a venue of this type. While off from women or superwomen who balance family and job responsibilities, we Revitzins deal with additional issues in the Kehillah and are truly on the front lines, needing strategies and assistance to deal properly and effectively. Revitzins have the closest relationship to the Kehillah's Rav, who needs his Eishes Chayil to be aware and sensitive to community issues and problems. This year, we thought it was crucial to address how to deal with difficult situations that so many are painfully confronting. We have an all-star lineup of speakers who we have no doubt will give you amazing insights to bring home. Please share what you learn with your husbands and encourage them to bring these matters to the attention of your shul. Running a program is much more involved than just setting a date and sending out the card. It has been an honor to work with our committee, and I'd like to acknowledge their assistance at this time. Hannah White from Project Eden, Dr. Hindi Klein from OHEL, Shane D. Gewertz from Women's League Community Residence, Ruchama Klatman of MASC, Revitzin Chaya Shandel Mandel of MASC, Revitzin Chaya Shandel Mandel of HASC, Revitzin S.D. Reisman, and of course our co-chair of the task force, Dr. Peggy Zackheim of Met Council. Dr. Zackheim is so sorry that she cannot be here with us today. She is dealing with a family issue that is very connected to our theme of the day. Our thoughts and prayers are with the Zackheim family. We truly appreciate the partnership of OHEL, whose generosity made this program possible, and we appreciate the presence today of Mr. David Mandel, CEO. We'd also like to thank the Lakewood Courtyard for their sponsorship and encourage you to visit their table located on the upper level of this floor to investigate their valuable resources. Our Hakara Satov to Yitzi Deutsch of Signature Events New York for assistance throughout the planning of this program. I also want to call your attention to Mr. Zalman Umlis, who is always here to help record the program, and he will be selling CDs of the program afterwards. It is my privilege now to turn the program over to Revitzin S.D. Reisman, whose words of Torah are always a special part of the program and a treat for all of us to hear. Thank you so much for coming, and have a wonderful day.
Our theme today is sailing, smooth sailing on stormy seas. The Gemara in Baba Basra has a series of fantastic tales about sailing, about travel on boats, about colossal waves, about mammoth upheavals, a series of tales that have profound allegorical meaning. I want to take one of these stories and just discuss it on a very simple level. Amar Rabbi Bar Rachana, Zimna Chada Hava Ka'azlinan Besvinta. One time, once we were traveling on a boat, V'chazinan Hahu Kavra, and we saw huge fish. D'yosfale Chosa Gabe, that somehow sand, dirt had accumulated on its back. The kadach agma ilave, and grass and vegetation had grown on the back of this fish. Savrinan yabeshtahi. So we thought that this fish was an island. We saw an island, and so we embarked. We disembarked from the ship, and we climbed up onto this island. V'salkinan v'afinan u'vashlinan agabe. And we had a barbecue, a picnic. We cooked, we baked on this fish. We were having a grand time. But what happened? V'chad cham gabe. When the back of the fish got too hot, Is hapeich? The fish suddenly rolled over. The ilav dehava mikorva spinta? Had our boat not been right there, hava tavinan, we would certainly have drowned. Sometimes we think that we're on solid ground. Sometimes we think that we're on firm footing, but it's an illusion. Things can turn over in a moment. When I was looking through the description of waves, the Gemara describes how high and how low these waves were. Well, we certainly can relate to that this year. We've seen what waves can do. Displace people, destroy homes, businesses, Sifrei Torah, wash away babies from their mother's arms. We've seen the colossal destruction that can be caused by waves. And we have seen in so many ways how a person's world, a person could be feeling secure, smooth sailing, and suddenly a person's world turns over. And if not for the boat nearby, we would have drowned. Most Mefarshim explain the boat nearby. Ilmalei Svinas HaTorah V'HaTshuva HaKrova. If not for our emuna, if not for Torah, if not for the possibility of tshuva, we would drown. And I'd like to add, today we're going to be talking about boats. The boats of emuna, the boats of tefillah, and the boat of chesed. The unbelievable chesed, the caring, the concern, you know, the plumbers from Kiryas Yol, people coming from Baltimore, people digging out sewage from people's basements and coming and coming and coming, what do you need and what can we do? The unbelievable Avas Yisrael that we experienced was so powerful. Those were certainly our boats. If not for the boats of Klal Yisrael's concern for one another, we would surely have drowned. I saw firsthand this year a dear friend of mine suddenly, with catastrophic suddenness, lost her husband on what started out as a peaceful Shabbos afternoon. And her children, aged 2, 5, and 7, had gone to their bubby's house just after Shabbos to have Shabbos party. And suddenly, her island turned over. And I saw firsthand how, as a shattering reality had to be faced, her number one question was, what do I tell the children? And I saw how Zahava was such a lifeline of support. She came that night, she came the next morning, and afterwards her little daughter said, can I speak to the pretty lady again? So today, we're going to talk about boats. What we can do, how we can support one another, how we can cope, how we can help one another experience smooth sailing on stormy seas.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rebbetzin Reisman. As you know, Rebbetzin Reisman has been a staunch believer, comes every year, and we're so grateful to her for all her advice and guidance in making this the successful day it is. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Marcel Bieberfeld, who's here joining us. Dr. Marcel Bieberfeld is the co-chair with Feige Zakheim of the task force. Just want to say a few words of welcome.
Yeah, I do just want to say a few words. And I can't help but thinking of the topic of smooth sailing in what's the sentence? Traumatic seas. You know, we have to look, we owe in our kavanah is also the stormy across the seas, what's going on in Eretz Yisrael, so we should all have that in Zin also. There's a lot of stormy seas going on in Eretz Yisrael. My job is really to welcome everybody, but I heard something last night that I just feel I have to share. I was so taken with this vort that Mama Leia taught all of us, and that's so apropos to this subject today. You know, everybody thinks when Yehuda was born, so Leia gave Kodesh Baruch Hu, Geshvach Kodesh Baruch Hu, and she said, now I can give real Apam Oides Hashem. So everybody thinks Apam Oides Hashem. She got one more than everybody else, so she feels she can give Apam Oides Hashem. I heard something so beautifully, very different. And that is, she said like this, my cheshbon was everyone, four mothers, everybody should get three. So when I got four, I recognized that if I got four, then someone may only have gotten two, or maybe one, or maybe none. And she said, you know something? I might have gotten none. So when she got the fourth, she recognized, I don't, quote-unquote, deserve necessarily anything. I can't take for granted anything. I see even the first that I got, I have to give a shlach to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I think the point is, without stormy seas, chas v'shalom, we take for granted. Every once in a while, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us a little nisoin to tell us, don't take things for granted. Nothing can be taken for granted. And every little thing we get, we got to give to shvach to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. On behalf of Fegi and myself and all the executive committee, all the members of the task force, I want to thank the Rebbetzins, all the Rebbetzins, the speakers, for joining us and for taking part of this. Could we possibly do the following? Besides what's going on at Yisrael, we have a lot of cholim here. Fegi at the moment is not here because she is with her husband just for the day in the hospital. Shlom Eliezer ben Chayasar Elke, Besor Shor Chali Yisrael. I would ask everybody, just quietly to yourselves, for a minute and two, just say one small kapitel of Tilim to yourselves, Bishchus and L'Refuah Shalema L'Chol Cholam Yisrael. Thank you. Well, his name is Shlom Eliezer ben Chayasar Elke, and I would always add Besor Shor Chali Yisrael.
Good afternoon. My name is Chai Shendel Mandel, and I'm a proud member of the task force representing HASC. It's my honor to introduce a very, very special person. Zahava Farbman, a social worker, is the associate director of the Crisis Intervention, Trauma, and Bereavement Department of Chai Lifeline. She's a practicing social worker who has built a career offering crisis intervention and bereavement services. For the past 16 years, Zahava has worked for Chai Lifeline, initially as one of the directors of Camp Simcha, which is Chai Lifeline's camp for children with cancer and other medical issues. For the last decade, she's served as associate director of the Crisis Intervention, Trauma, and Bereavement Department at Chai Lifeline, dealing with the full scope of crises, traumas, and tragedies in an individual, family, and community level, locally, nationally, and internationally. She's the responder to mental health emergencies from Atzala of the Five Towns, Far Rockaway, and communities in New York City. Zahava is a very unique and extraordinary person. You know, sometimes we face crises and we just don't know what to say. Zahava knows what to say. She's been gifted with beauty inside and out. She's a veritable example of chesed in action. She lives in Woodmere with her husband and children, and I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce Zahava Farbman.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Mandel. So I too am a proud member of the task force representing Chai Lifeline. Just a couple of minutes more about the task force. The task force is a collaboration of over 40 agencies, representatives of over 40 agencies, mental health agencies from the New York area. The goal of the task force is to utilize our combined resources to create programs and events to help the community in the betterment of the children and family. This Robertson's Conference, which is a yearly event, is just one event during the year that the task force puts together. The task force has been very successful in furthering the awareness in the Jewish community of many, many mental health issues. For the last 15 years, as we know, Baruch Hashem, the Jewish community has become more aware, more open, more vocal about issues facing our children and our families. And that is really a tremendous credit to the task force, Fagi Zakheim and Dr. Bieberfeld. And I really am humbled sitting at these meetings once every 6 weeks with really amazing professionals, each one in their area of expertise. So once again, a very big yisher koach to the task force and the committee for putting together this wonderful event. I'm very proud to be here today as one of the speakers, along with my fellow professionals on the program, Dr. Blumenthal and Rebbetzin Feiner, who will be here shortly. It's a tremendous chus for me, and I hope, with the help of Hashem, we'll learn some things together that you can bring back to your communities. It really is so impressive, this large group of Rebbetzins coming here today. It shows that as Rebbetzins of the first ladies of your communities, that you care about your families, you care about your communities enough to come out here today during the week and learn things and gain skills that you can bring back to your communities to help the family. So really, yisher koach to you. And I stand here not only as a fellow female wife and mother, but I grew up the daughter of a Rav and a Rebbetzin. I grew up the daughter of a Rav and a Rebbetzin leading a very large community. And I really saw with my own eyes, and I really lived until high school, and I saw the myriad of issues that my parents dealt with. And I have an idea of some of the issues that you deal with today. And I can relate to that. And again, it gives me a very, you know, warm sense of pride that you have come here to learn more how to help those families. I also come here as a professional in dealing with crises for the last 16 years. I represent High Lifeline, really one of the largest Jewish community-based organizations in the world. I know that many of you know about Camp Simcha, right? After all, how many of you have girls in your community that either, girls and boys, that have either wanted to go to camp as staff, been to camp as staff, or on the waiting list for camp as staff, right? And no, I have nothing to do with this, so don't ask me to get those girls into camp. But a department in High Life that not so many people know about, in the last decade it's grown more and more, is Project Chai. And the history of Project Chai is that, unfortunately, not every child makes it. The children who have cancer and other medical issues, lo aleinu, Hashem yirachem. And that's how the department started, years ago, responding to the families of High Lifeline that unfortunately lost children. And as the Jewish community has experienced more and more tragedies, you know, Hashem yishmor, Mashiach should come tomorrow and I should go out of business, but the department has started responding to all of those crises and tragedies. Last year alone, we responded to over 600 situations in the Jewish community. And you'll see some of these situations and the numbers in the brochure in your folder. What we will do today, hopefully with the help of Hashem, will give you some tips to bring back to your communities. I'm sure that as Rebbetzins, families come to you with different situations, and hopefully we'll provide some take-home tips for you to help those communities, and with the knowledge also that we're there to help in any situation that arises. So let's start with just running through the developmental stages. Different ages, different kids, different families, you know, some tips on how to respond to those different ages. And we're going to start with preschool, okay? When we talk to preschool kids, we'll start by asking them, what makes you happy? What makes you sad? Right? Just to get them start to think about emotions and think about feelings. And by the way, I just caveat, a crisis doesn't only have to be a death, right? In my iPhone dictionary, the dictionary on my phone, if you look under the word crisis, there are three definitions. And one of them is anything that happens that disrupts the normal routine of an individual or a family. So a crisis can be a death. A crisis can be a diagnosis of an illness. A crisis can be living with an illness. A crisis can be a divorce, a financial struggle, anything that disrupts the normal routine of an individual or a family. Okay, so preschool kids, just to start to get them, you know, thinking about feelings, because they don't really have the language to say, you know, I'm sad, I'm scared, but what types of things make you happy? What types of things make you sad? And they'll give you different examples, and then, you know, we can start in the conversation, well, you know, today we're going to talk about something sad. Preschool age kids do not understand the finality of death. They don't understand, you know, that it's forever. And when we talk to kids about death, sometimes I'll say to them, you know, you said that Yankee's father died. What does that word mean to you? What does that word mean? Because many times preschool kids will just be parroting things that their parents said, and the word died or the word passed away. It'll just be a word that they use, but they don't understand what it means. And we want to make sure that they don't understand myths about death, such as he went to sleep for a very long time, or he went away for a very long time. Because what will happen is kids will be scared to go to sleep, or kids will be scared the next time their father has to go on a business trip. So as adults, we have to say the words, we're not going to see Yankee's father again. As hard as it is as sometimes for, as adults to say those words, it's very important that it's said. Preschool age kids, their whole world is 5 minutes. Their whole world is Dalet Amos. So sometimes, you know, we tell a kid something, and right away they'll, you know, run off to the next thing. Okay, what's for snack? You know, great. But then they'll come back with questions later. One of my strongest examples of an intervention that I did with a preschool age kid is, it's 2.5 years ago, where a 3-year-old boy in my own neighborhood didn't wake up one morning. And I had the unfortunate experience of going to his class to tell these 3-year-olds that their friend is not coming back. This happened during their winter vacation. So the teacher told me for the rest of the year, for all those months, the kids kept coming back to her and saying, where's Mickey? When is he coming back from vacation? Is he still away? Right? They didn't get it. Their whole world is 5 minutes. They didn't understand the finality of it. They couldn't wrap their heads, you know, around where he is and when is he coming back. And many will ask questions that, honestly, some of us adults are thinking about. You know, how did he get to Shemayim? The next time when I go on a plane this summer to Eretz Yisrael, I'm going to see him, right? Because he's up there in the clouds, right? Or if I take a ladder, I'll be able to see Mickey, right? That's clear. That's obvious, right? They will verbalize things that, you know, they don't have that little filter to say, oh, maybe this is an appropriate thing to say. In fact, the same child had a brother in fifth grade, a 5-year-old brother in pre-1A. And I spoke to his class, and I explained to the kids that their friend's brother died. And as I was walking out, they were bringing the 5-year-old back into school. And he's walking in, and one of his friends walk over to him and say, Yessie, that lady just said that your brother died. He didn't really die, right? And Yessie said, yeah, he did. And he went and he hung up his coat and went on with his day. The situation that Rebbetzin Reisman was just talking about, those little girls, one of them was in preschool, and she was asking questions like, and again, questions that adults might think about, questions like, so when Mashiach comes, you know, if we're older, how is Daddy going to recognize us? Very good question, right? Okay, let's move on to school-age kids. School-age kids are focused on details. They want to know the who, what, where, when, how did it look like, how did it happen, because they feel like if they can wrap their little heads around it, if they understand it, then it won't happen to them. I remember many years ago, there was a horrible fire in Teaneck, New Jersey, where unfortunately several kids in the family died. So we were in different schools, different classes, all ages. And when I really saw some of the things that I speak about, the preschool age, you know, we act according to like this, and the school age kids like this, and the high school kids like this, because we covered the whole gamut. And I remember the school age kids asking, how did the fire start? How did the kids get out? How did the bodies look, you know, that didn't make it? They wanted to know all those details. Excuse me. School age kids are capable of sympathy, but not empathy. School-age kids can understand the concept of rare and unusual. How many times my husband already makes fun of me? I know, it's rare and unusual. How many times I say that to kids, Because really, even an illness, you know, unfortunately, as common as cancer is in our community, for kids, it's still a rare and unusual situation, not something that you need to be scared of. Sometimes school-age kids will see delayed reactions, you know, later in the game. I'm dealing with a family right now whose father died suddenly a few months ago. And the first couple months, the fourth grade kid was doing okay, you know, no real reactions. She was going about her business. Now, a couple months later, it's starting to come out. School-age kids, make sure that they know there is open, I mean, for all kids, open and honest communication. You want to hear from them. Even if they think it's going to upset you, you want to hear their questions. You want to hear their concerns. And you want to make sure to tell those kids, okay, again, all kids, the information, right? If there's something that you think they're going to hear on the school bus at recess, you know, some information, you know, that might be scary or shocking or sad or anything, you make sure that you hear it from them. Okay? We saw this a lot, Dr. Blumenthal will remember, after the Leiby Kletsky situation, where we had thousands and thousands and thousands of parents calling in and asking us questions. And the majority of the questions were, how do I tell my kids? What do I tell my kids? And unfortunately, as difficult as it is, the answer is you need to tell them those details because you know what? They're going to hear it. They're going to hear it on the school bus. They're going to hear it at recess, and you would rather hear from them, especially today with the texts and the internet and the speed in which information, you know, flows. They'll hear it, you know, sooner than you think. And again, you would rather them hear it from you. I preach this all the time, and I didn't learn my own lesson. 5 weeks ago now, 6 weeks ago, my uncle suddenly died. Suddenly was Nifter. And my aunt, I don't know where she is, she's sitting here today. And right after he was Nifter, you know, even before the Levaya, we're sitting at my grandparents, they should live and be well, and this aunt was busy running to her daughter's school to make sure that the kids don't find out from someone else. And this uncle was busy, you know, speaking to his wife who should go to that school to make sure she doesn't hear from anyone else. And I'm busy helping them and guiding them, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Several hours later, I get a phone call from my son in Far Rockaway. Ima, what happened? Did I think that my kid in Darkei Torah in Far Rockaway is going to hear from his principal who heard from this one, from that one, from that one? So I didn't learn my own lesson. So if there's something that you think your kids are going to hear, you make sure to tell it to them. You need to prepare these kids very well for what they're going to see, what they're going to hear. If it's a hospital visit, if it's a levaya, just a couple weeks ago, maybe some of you saw an article on Yeshiva World News that my colleague Rabbi Klar wrote about a story where a mother died after an illness, and he helped prepare the kids to go say goodbye. And he went through the details about how he spoke to the kids and what he told the kids and how he prepared them to go to the hospital to say goodbye to their mother. And one thing he did that I thought was brilliant, when they came to the hospital, he took them to an empty hospital room. And he said, this is the type of room that that you're going to see your mother in, just to prepare them for the sights, the sounds, for what they're going to see in order to say goodbye to their mother. And we'll get questions, especially with school-age kids, you know, should we bring them to the levaya? Should we bring them to the hospital? And I'm sure you as Rebbetzins, your husbands, will get these types of questions. And what we suggest is that people in crisis tend to think of that moment. What's going to get me through this minute? What's going to make it easier for this minute? And what we need to do is to help them think about tomorrow, next week, next year, 10 years from now. And yes, maybe today it would be easier not to bring the kids to the levaya or not to bring the kids to the hospital. But you know what? Emir Tasham, these kids are going to grow up. And you never want them to say to you, you didn't let me say goodbye to my mother. You didn't let me, you know, you didn't give me that closure of coming to the levaya or coming to the hospital. We had a very, very powerful example of this. A woman lost her baby at a very young age. And the Rav didn't want her to go see the baby, you know, to have that moment of closure, of goodbye. So we spoke to the Rav and we explained, you know, the importance of it, and he relented. And we took her to the funeral home, and she saw her baby. She said goodbye to her baby. And she came out, and we were driving her home. And she was hysterical crying, but really uncontrollable crying. And after a few minutes, she collected herself, and she said, I'm not just crying about my baby. She said, when I was a little girl, my mother died, and they didn't let me go to the levaya, and they didn't let me have that final goodbye. This goodbye to my baby was a goodbye to my mother. So again, to help them think La'asid, the future. Okay, let's turn to teenagers. Such a fun stage, right? I'm in that now. I have a bunch of teenagers, Baruch Hashem. Teenagers, when something happens, it's sometimes their first awareness and their first, you know, mature thinking, and you know what? Something can happen to me. Something can happen to my family. These things are really happening. Teenagers are able to empathize and not just sympathize. Teenagers will start thinking hashkafically, tzadik v'ralo type questions. Sometimes, you know, I know with my kids, sometimes as a parent, the best gift we can give to our children is someone else to talk to, right? If we don't always know the answers, you know what? Speak to Rabbi so-and-so. Speak to the rabbitson. You know, sit down and ask out these questions. But teenagers also have the capacity to understand that there are unanswered questions. Teenagers, of course, you always run the risk of rebellion. Teenagers need to be action-oriented. Giving them something to do, you know, not just, you know, everything will be okay, something to do, something to help express their feelings, something to help express their emotions, to do something for the Nifter's family, to do something L'Zeicha Nishmas, to take on a project is very, very therapeutic for them, and it's always therapeutic for the Nifter's family that they see that, you know, these kids care enough to do something. But to always guide the kids to take on something manageable and not overwhelming. What do I mean? I dealt with a group of teenage girls. They decided that, you know, L'Zeicha Nishmas, they're going to daven for the rest of their life with Kavana. Well, what do you think happened day three when they were up late studying for a test and the next morning Shacharis, not so much Kavana. They felt very guilty. They felt horrible. So instead of davening for the rest of my life with Kavana, maybe say Asher Yetzer with Kavana. You know, maybe choose Shema. Choose something manageable that they'll be able to accomplish and feel good about. All kids, you know, a few issues relating to all kids. All kids need safety, security, consistency, routine. Going back to school, you know, much of our work is also guiding staff and guiding teachers. And sometimes teachers, you know, from a good place, right, they'll think, you know, oh, you don't have to take this test. You're exempt from this homework assignment. Don't worry about it. You've been through so much. It's not such a chesed. It's not such a chesed because these kids will get used to that and they'll get into the groove of, you know, taking advantage and relying, you know, blaming what, you know, on what they went through. But rather to get them back into consistency and back into routine. And yes, you have to do these homework assignments and you have to take this test. Shefala, maybe you need somebody to study with. That we can arrange, right? But to help them get back into routine. Another issue that, you know, as a Rebbetzin, maybe sometimes you have dealt with, and this is something that I deal with across the board, all ages and all spectrums, you know, from the most from to the most secular, and that is the issue of unanswered tfilos, right? That kids will say, but we davened, right? I dealt with a situation in the Five Towns where a girl became sick very, very quickly, you know, overnight, and within a few days she passed away. And those few days in her school, they were davening around the clock, and they took on this Kabbalah and this Chesed and this, you know, Rufu Shalema, and came after a few days, and unfortunately their friends died. But we davened. I don't understand. So as Rebbetzins, you know, this is something I'm very passionate about, and I heard it from Rav Matasiah Solomon, that to guide teachers in that, starting from the Moed Ani, when they start to learn Moed Ani in nursery, in kindergarten, in pre-1A, Hashem loves your tefillos. Hashem takes your tefillos and uses every single one of them. We just don't always know where. We don't always know how. The most powerful example I have of this is several years ago, I was in a girls' high school in New Jersey, and they called me in because there were several things going on. Within a span of a few weeks, one father died. One father was diagnosed. A husband of a staff member died. There was just a lot going on in the school. So I'm standing in front of the whole school, and I'm talking, and we're talking about this issue of unanswered tefillos. A girl in the back raises her hand and stands up, and she says, "You're here. One of the reasons you're here is because of me. My father died a few weeks ago." And she said, right before, about a couple weeks before he died, he had to go through a very painful and serious and important procedure. And the doctors warned us, you know, this is a very painful procedure, this is a very difficult procedure. So I knew that while he was going through this procedure, my friends, you guys, were all davening in school, my parents' friends gathered in the shul, and they were all davening. while this procedure was going on. And after a couple hours, the doctor came out, and he said, "I don't know, someone's looking out for your father. He went through it with flying colors. We could tell by the heart rate he wasn't in pain. It was successful." And at that point, she became very emotional, and she said, "It was because of you. It was because of your tefillos." She said, "Yes, my father died, unfortunately, but because of your tefillos, he didn't suffer through that procedure." I certainly didn't have to say anything further. A question of Mashiach with kids, right? Mashiach is a yisod of our Yahadus, an imam, ibn shalem, and we daven for Mashiach every single day. And kids will inevitably say, you know, Tati died, and you're not going to see him again until Mashiach comes, which is true. But with kids, we have to, again, give them the context of time, especially the little kids whose whole world is 5 minutes. Because what happens is that kids will be standing at the door the next day. Where's Mashiach? You said, "I'm going to see Mashiach. You said, I'm going to see Tati when Mashiach comes." So to give them an idea of, you know what, even our Bubbies and Zadies were waiting for Mashiach. And yes, we hope Mashiach's going to come every single day, but we don't know when. We don't know when. And again, even our Bubbies and our Zadies, you know, we're waiting for Mashiach. Sometimes kids' imaginations are worse than reality, right? Going back to what I said. 2 minutes. Really? Okay. Going back to what I said about talking to kids and explaining to kids, right? Sometimes kids, you know, if we don't explain to kids on their level, sometimes their imagination is worse than reality. And an example of this is actually not a High Lifeline story, but my stepfather was a counselor in a camp years ago, and he and his father worked there also. And his father was a doctor, and the two of them were involved in Taharos. Okay, so one day, unfortunately, there was a lightning storm, and a kid was hit by lightning, and he died. So again, my stepfather and his father were involved in the Sahara. Fast forward 30 years, okay, 30 years fast forward, and my stepfather is standing in a shul one day, and a man comes over to him and says, "You know, excuse me, are you Michael Novogoder?" My stepfather says, "Yes," and this man's face went white, and he said, "I need to know. What did my brother's body look like?" So my stepfather said, "What do you mean? He looked beautiful. He looked fine." He said he had a little red dot where the buckle was, but otherwise he was fine. He was perfect. The man started crying and shaking and said, "My parents never told me. My parents never spoke to me about it. And all these years, I'm imagining my brother's body shriveled and burnt." Okay. Okay, so I'm going to fast forward a lot because I only have a few minutes left. I wanted to go through some typical coping mechanisms. And just suffice it to say that there are myriads of ways that kids and adults can cope, can feel, can react, can respond to a tragedy happening. There's no right way, there's no wrong way. Okay, sad, happy, angry, guilty, and I have tons of examples and tons of stories for each one of them. But I think the most important job as a Rebbetzin is just to validate. Whatever you're feeling is fine, okay? It's not like in school where if you say 2 + 2 = 5 and your teacher says, no, that's wrong. When it comes to the way you're feeling, thinking, reacting, responding about a tragedy, no one can tell you you're wrong. Okay, no one can tell you you're wrong, and every single one is different. Don't compare one to the other. And again, if anyone wants to hear some of the stories, some of the examples, I'll be happy to share afterwards. But also in the way we react and respond. Sometimes we just need to give a kid a mode of expression, a way to get it out, because not all kids are talkers and not all kids are criers. Some need to write, some need to color, some need to sing, to draw, to daven, to take a walk. Everyone is different, adults and children. And again, there are so many examples I can give of different ways of coping and responding. I'm going to end with two very quick short stories that I think really speak to the role of a Rebbetzin, in a role of a mentor, a role of anybody in a crisis and a tragedy. The first story is a story that I heard from my Rav, Rav Moshe Weinberger, years ago in the old city of Yerushalayim. There were two little orphans, right? Their mother had died years before, and their father now died. And he was going to be Menachem Avil, and as any good Rav, he was coming with his entourage of students. And they sit down, And after a few minutes, the rep starts telling stories of the kid's father. And after a little while, he told a bunch of stories. He said the hamakom, and he left. And they walked out, and the students said to their rep, but Rebbe, what about the halacha, that the aveilim are supposed to speak first? And the rep said, speak first? What do you mean? You didn't look into their eyes and hear them screaming? You didn't hear those screams? I was just responding to what they were saying to me. And sometimes, as Rebbetzins, as mentors, as people dealing with families in crisis, sometimes we have to hear what is said without being said. Sometimes we have to look into the children's eyes, parents' eyes, people in pain, and respond to what we're hearing without the words. And finally, my last story is a story from a man, Michael Levy, who lives in my neighborhood. Michael is blind. He's married to his wife, Javi, who is a paraplegic. They have two wonderful children. Michael was once speaking from the pulpit, and he told the following story. He said when he was young, all his friends would walk to school by themselves. And him being blind, he was never able to. His mother would have to take him to school every day. And one morning he said, Mom, that's it. I want to walk to school. I want to be like everybody else, right? Like every kid wants to be like everyone else. I want to walk to school. So they practiced. His mother took him out of the house, made a left, walked 16 steps, made a right, took 32 steps, et cetera, et cetera. And after a couple of weeks, Michael said, Mom, I'm ready to do it by myself. I've memorized it. I know what I'm doing. I want to do it by myself. So the first morning, he walked out of his house. He made a left. He took 16 steps. He made a right. He took 32 steps until he finally got to school. And the guard said, good morning, Michael. And then the guard said, good morning, Mrs. Levy. And Michael heard the swoosh of her mother's bike, you know, going away. But Michael said, I knew without a shadow of a doubt until the day my mother died that she was always with me, that she was supporting me, whatever it is I went through. The job of a Rebbetzin, I think, from where I'm standing, is to give that over to your families, that I'm here, I'm supporting you, whatever it is that you're going through. I want to say to you that High Lifeline is also there in the background to support you, the Rebbetzins, to support your families, whatever it is that you're going through. Meretz Hashem should only be good things. But that network of support for you to be there for your families, for whatever that they're going through, for High Lifeline to be there for you, to support you, supporting your families, whatever it is you're going through. And in Meretz Hashem, this is all theoretical. Mashiach's coming tomorrow, and we're only going to have happy occasions.
My name is Hindi Klein, and I am a proud member of the task force since its inception. I'm on the executive committee, and the work that we do, Zahava mentioned some of the work that we do. We are very proud of the work that we do, and we're very proud that we're able to put together a function like this for the Rebbetzins every year. We have a beautiful turnout. I always see so many friendly and familiar faces that I'm able to greet every year. And I really thank you all for coming and listening and participating in our events. You know, Zahava just had a beautiful presentation about the developmental stages on how children of different ages respond to trauma. And I also want to bring to your attention that we have a booklet that very much talks about developmental stages of trauma for children. And it's out front at the table, and it's called How to Talk to Your Children About Trauma and Tragedy, Preschool, Elementary, and High School. So on your way out, these booklets are really very informative. It breaks it down also to stages and talks about the different stages and how children react in different stages, and also the coping mechanisms and the interventions for each stage. So I welcome your participation in taking one of those booklets. It is my pleasure and honor, an exciting honor, to introduce Dr. Norman Blumenthal, who is OHEL Director of Trauma, Bereavement, and the Rapid Response Team. Dr. Blumenthal is a licensed clinical psychologist in private practice in Cedarhurst, New York, in addition to being our director of OHEL's Trauma Unit. He received his master's in 1976 and his doctorate in 1981 from Adelphi University. Dr. Blumenthal is the educational director of the Bella and Harry Wexner Kollel Elyon and Tzmicha Honors Program at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University, REITS, which provides training in counseling, public speaking, and the like to prospective rabbis. He is the founder and chairman of the Board of Education of Kahal, which is a partnership of 10 local Jewish schools providing special education services. In addition, Dr. Blumenthal serves as the coordinator of group psychotherapy training for interns and residents at the North Shore Long Island Jewish Health System and a consultant to the TOVA mentoring program in Long Island. And he's also a past vice president of NEFESH, which is another very important organization. It's the International Organization of Orthodox from Mental Health Professionals. So without further ado, and it's really wonderful to have Dr. Blumenthal here, and I present to you Dr. Norman Blumenthal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hindi. That was a great introduction. About 10% of it is true. People sometimes comment when they hear all those positions I have. They say, you have four jobs. And I said, yeah, I have one job for each tuition. But anyway, before I start, I want to acknowledge the committee, Fagi, Henna, Hindi. I hope I'm not leaving out anybody. But I want to also comment on the brilliance of the choice of the topic. As many of you know, I do a lot of public speaking. And one of the challenges when you do a lot of public speaking is that your speeches shouldn't become repetitive or stale. So I always make an effort to make sure that it's personally meaningful to me, the topic. And therefore, I want to commend the committee that picked the subject today as trauma, because personally, I can think of very few things that are more traumatic than speaking to 200 Rebbetzins. So I'm feeling the trauma very acutely. Also, many of you may know that I just took over as Director of Trauma and Bereavement and Crisis Intervention for Oral Children and Family Services. And it's my very special privilege today to show an artist's rendition of OHEL's new crisis center that they will be building. And I think as you see it, you'll see what a sea of tranquility this will be for the Jewish community. This is the OHEL's new crisis intervention center. You can see what a bastion of control and compassion it is. This is me over here running away, showing my usual courage and temerity. There's Hindi with a new set of glasses that she hasn't worn yet. Yeah, right over there. I hope you know I'm joking. Okay, let me tell you what I hope to cover today. My subject is the community. And what I'd like to do, and maybe it's not a very big crowd, we might have been a little bit of a chance, let me just keep an eye on the clock, to have a little bit of a sort of give and take. But what I'm going to hope to cover, Mitzvah Hashem, is the vital role of the community. I'm going to share with you some fascinating research which shows how vital and important the community is. We're going to talk about two types of trauma, uppercase T and lowercase T. This is actually a term that David Mendel uses, and I think it's a very good one in terms of the two types of trauma, capital T, lowercase T. We're going to have some fun comparing two different communities and how they responded to a tragedy. And if time permitting, I would like to talk a little bit about what's really at the cutting edge of trauma today, which is generation lockdown. Okay, interesting. A 2007 longitudinal study of 1,420 children ages 9 to 16, which was published in the Archives of General Psychiatry, found that potentially traumatic events are common in children, but do not typically result in post-traumatic stress symptoms or disorders. So contrary to popular belief, most children, and by the way, the same statistics are true for adults, most children will experience at least one trauma, but don't necessarily have a post-trauma reaction. The study found that 2/3 of children reportedly experienced at least one traumatic event by age 16, including 31% with exposure to one event and 37% to multiple events. So most children, by the time they're 16, have had an exposure to a traumatic event. Of those, about 13% developed some post-traumatic stress symptoms by age 16, but less than 0.5% met the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. So the vast majority, without any assistance or any obvious assistance, or professional assistance, let's say, are able to experience a trauma and yet somehow or another manage this and not have post-traumatic stress symptoms. How do we explain this? Okay, so that's what I'm going to discuss. Studies by Dr. Paul Plotsky, known in the literature of trauma as the 15-180 studies. So it seems that a rat in the wild, this was done with rats and their children, a rat in the wild typically leaves the nest for about 15 minutes to forage for food and then comes back. So what Dr. Plotsky did was, he had these rats in the cage, he took the mother rat out for about 15 minutes, brought the mother rat back, and everything was fine. you know, they were hugging and kissing. Everything was beautiful. Then he took the mother rat out of the cage for 180 minutes. And when he brought the mother back, there was bona fide trauma among the children rats. They were hissing, screaming, running around. The mother started to attack the children, and it was gefährlich. They had to call in Child Protective Services. Owl had to place the rats in foster homes. You know, it was there was really bona fide trauma. Okay, so another study showing that the absence of the parental figure, the caretaker, causes trauma. Now, here's where it gets interesting. A few years later, Dr. Platsky had an Einfall. He had an interesting idea. And this time, he replicated the study. He took the mother rat out for 15 minutes, and then he took her out for 180 minutes. But this time, when he brought her back to a different setting. He didn't bring the mother back to the same cage. He brought her back to a very beautiful, luxurious, comfortable cage. In other words, he took the rats out of their two-bedroom apartment in Borough Park, and he put them in the 13th Avenue Plaza. Anybody want to take a guess what the reaction was? Great. Does that great mean they bad, good?
Good.
Very good. There was indistinguishable response by the mother than when she had returned after 15 minutes. What does that tell us? If you're going to be a rat, you should be a rich rat, no? What does this tell us? Anybody want to take a guess? Nobody wants to speak up. Huh? Something new. Okay. So one thing, okay, one point is that if you return to this, if you're the same person when you come back from the trauma, it's traumatic. If you come back different, somehow growing, it's a little hard to imagine rats growing, but that helps. What else does it teach us? That's a good point, though. I think it's relevant as well. So perhaps what it tells us is more important than the trauma or the nature or extent of the trauma is the setting to which the traumatized person returns. And if the setting to which the traumatized person returns is a warm, loving, comfortable setting, that can undo an experience that otherwise would be highly traumatic. Or another way of putting it is perhaps Hashem, for reasons that we can't fathom, decided that people are going to experience trauma in their lives. But he made the refuah before the makkah, because if you come back to a warm, loving community or family, you can absorb that trauma. So it shows you how vitally important both the family and the community is when people have been traumatized, and that a proper communal response can really undo even horrific trauma. Yeah?
You're assuming that just the mother had the trauma by coming back.
No, the kids also. The kids, they were both ways. I'm sorry, the study, the animal, the kids were also brutalizing the parents. We just, there's no parental protective services, unfortunately. There should be, though. Okay. Now, just in case you think that this is only with rats, we see that's with humans as well. And this, by the way, study should really resonate with us because it really speaks to what was part of our history as well. An anthropologist, Dr. Brandon Kaur, in 2006, studied Nepalese children between ages 5 and 14 who were coerced into medical service for Maoist rebels, witnessing much violence and trauma. So just like the Tsar, Yimach Shemo, would come in, they would come into the community, kidnap every child from ages 5 to 14, put them into mandatory conscription, seeing horrible trauma, and then they returned home to the villages. And this anthropologist studied the response when they came home to the villages. And what he found was that those villages that ostracized and rejected these young children, there was a very high incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder. Yet the villages that welcomed them back, that had ceremonies and dedications commemorating their return, had a sudos mitzvah, etc., practically no post-traumatic stress disorder. So the manner and fashion with which the community embraces the traumatized can really make all the difference in the world. Many of us, I mean, I can see that I have contemporaries here, many of us can remember the situation after the Vietnam War, when in contrast to, let's say, World War II veterans, Vietnam War veterans came home to a hostile community. And you all know the high incidence of substance abuse, domestic violence, etc., among Vietnam War veterans. You could even venture to guess, and many of you may know, the military today is struggling with a very high incidence of suicide. among military veterans. We're not doing much for the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who are coming home. Similarly, some very interesting findings on Holocaust survivors. There was some data to suggest that Holocaust survivors in Israel fared much better than Holocaust survivors here in America and Canada. And several reasons were given, but one of them was that the whole raison d'etre of Israel was the Holocaust. And there's a Yom HaShoah and there's a Yad Vashem. It's so incorporated into culture so that they were able to absorb the trauma better. So we see then the importance of the community. So here's a quote from Pediatrics 2013. Although the majority of kids exposed to traumatic events rebound with the support of loving and caring family relationships, and you can add community, only a few kids start to have problems and develop signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. So how vitally important the community and the family is. Here we see an example of a community, or I guess a family response to trauma. She says, well, enough about me. What kind of day did you have? Okay. You can see he's from, by the way. He's wearing a hat, you know. Okay. Now, let's get into, do we respond to trauma? And what I'm going to propose to you now is that there are two types of trauma, one of which we are highly responsive to, and another one which, probably no fault of our own, we are rather unresponsive to. And for this, I want to share with you very quickly a very fascinating Gemara. The Gemara in Sota, Daf Chof Amud Beis, 20, talks about, we all know what the Sota is, it's a suspected adulteress, and she drinks that drink which has Hashem's name eradicated, and if she indeed was unfaithful, she has some immediate kind of anatomical response. Machlokas Nagmar, does she right away die? Does it linger? But there's a very clear, immediate anatomical response. And the Gemara says that, and I'll try to say this delicately, but the Gemara says that if she has that response, if she drinks it and she has a response and suggesting that she is guilty, they rush her off the Azara. They very quickly take her away. So Gemara asks why. Why do you have to take her away so quickly? So Gemara says, because of the shock, she'll become a Nida, and we have to take her away from the Azara. So the Gemara says, aye, but we have another Gemara that says that a woman who's in hiding because of marauders or invaders has the opposite effect. It postpones or curtails her becoming a Nida. So how do you put this together? And Chazal, in an inimitable fashion, in four words, sums up what it takes us hundreds of words to say. It says, Pach tzamis bi'usasam marpi. Ongoing fear contracts, sudden fear extracts. In other words, there's two types of traumas. There's a horrific sudden trauma. There's a Hurricane Sandy. There's a Sandy Hook shooting. There's an earthquake. There's a tsunami. That creates shrieking. That creates an expression, an outpouring. And the natural response of people to an outpouring is to come running to someone else's assistance. There's another kind of trauma, such as ongoing abuse, poverty, chronic illness, which has the opposite effect. The person buries themselves in their shell. They withdraw, and therefore we don't come running to assist them because they're not shrieking, they're not evoking in us the natural response. So, for example, the trauma with a capital T is exposure to mass destruction or death, exposure to the grotesque, loss of community and home, perceived life threat, disaster caused by deliberate act of man, and of course lecturing to Rebbetzins. These are all life-threatening events that cause someone to shriek and have obvious and frightening trauma. Trauma with the small t is ongoing molestation abuse, marital discord, divorce, financial stress, poverty, chronic illness, including mental illness, incarceration of a parent, child and drug rehab, and I have to add this, rejection by all community schools, a growing problem in our community. This is an ongoing perennial trauma, and that's the trauma that causes people to hide, and we don't respond to it, and this is where you come in as the Rebbetzins. Because it's you, with your Bina Yesera, with your intuition, that when you see someone withdrawing, when you see someone stopping to come to shul, when you see someone rushing home and not staying around and talking to people turning down invitations, not showing up to simchas, that should be a clue to you. That's the small t trauma, and that's where you have to reach out to them. And this is one of the lessons from Hurricane Sandy. Many of you may know that Orwell was the recipient of a very large grant, Project Hope. It was able to hire 35 new staff members to assist with the trauma of Hurricane Sandy in New York City. And I just want to mention parenthetically, we just got, more recently got a grant for Nassau County to provide services for communities or individuals who are still have the lingering effects of Hurricane Sandy. Like any grant, it's time limited, but we're in a position to offer free services. And if anybody knows someone, or if anybody here is from Nassau County, you should be want to make this available to be aware of this. But there are many lessons we learned from Hurricane Sandy. I just met with the 35 new staff members, and it was a very exhilarating experience. But one of them is the surprise, some of the sudden displacement, the stress of hosting, which was very interesting because many families were hosting other families, but also the therapeutic value of outpouring of assistance and support, even if not direct recipients. One of the things that helped the victims of Hurricane Sandy so much was knowing that the five towns raised $35 million, knowing that people took buses from Baltimore and from other communities to help dig them out, and even if they weren't the ones who received that assistance, but just being aware of it, being embraced by the community, knowing they're part of a community, was incredibly therapeutic. And, by the way, since this Project Hope grant services not just the Jewish community, but the broader community as well, there was almost like an envy between the staff addressing the Jewish community and the staff addressing the non-Jewish community because of the outpouring of support from the Jewish community. Again, we see how vitally important the community response is. Okay, here's an example, again, of a response to trauma. He's saying, how's everything while she does the Heimlich maneuver? Okay. Now, for a few minutes that we have left, I'd like to share with you a very interesting comparison. And again, this will have, there's a lesson in this, we'll see in a minute, of communities' responses to school shootings, lo aleinu. When I teach this, you know, I was mentioned that I run a program for Yeshiva University Smicha students. David Pelkovitz and I teach a pastoral psych class. And when I teach we teach the crisis and trauma portion, we actually compare six communities where there have been recently school shootings. But for simplicity's sake and lack of time, we're going to compare two different communities to a response to school shootings. We're going to compare Newtown, Connecticut, and Columbine, Colorado. Okay? Newtown, Connecticut, and this, by the way, was just 3 weeks ago. Newtown officials voted unanimously for a plan to tear down Sandy Hook Elementary School, the site of one of the worst school massacres in U.S. history, and rebuild a new school in its place. So Newtown decided they're going to tear down the school and build a brand new school. Okay. Columbine. After the 1999 Columbine High School massacre, the city reopened the school's doors after 4 months, turning the library where 13 students were killed into a memorial. The students returned cheering, quote, "We are Columbine," at a Take Back the School rally. Polar opposites. One community tore down the school and rebuilt it. The other one reopened the school and had a rally and had them come back and just change the library into a memorial. As the old joke goes, he's right, they both can't be right. Who's right? Both. Tell me why. You're right, I think, right? Well, go ahead. Why are they both right? Okay, important point. That's a good point. Newtown was an elementary school. Columbine is a high school. And therefore, it's much more, you can much more readily expect high school students to do this kind of reworking. It's sometimes referred to in literature as meaning-making in terms of trauma. The only fly in the ointment with that is that one of the other schools that I cite when I do all six schools was also an elementary school that did the same thing as Columbine. I can compare all six schools. Okay. All right, but it's true. That's a good point. I think it makes much more sense with Columbine. What happened? You just pulled out a plug, I think. It's a trauma, guys. Okay, here's your chance. Huh? Okay, I'll add more, sure. Yeah. Which one? Merkaz. Okay, that's interesting. Israel's a very, I mean, again, I didn't have, I went, no, if I'm, okay. Israel's style, by the way, as you may know, is clean it up quickly and reopen it right away. I understand from people who've been there that after a pagua or something like that, within hours, you would not know anything happened. Literally, it almost reminds me of when I have a secretary at Long Island Jewish, and you know, who's a Gentile woman, and the first time I told her to go, I was going to Israel, she burst into tears, and when I finally said, "Huh? What? Sorry." Okay. And when I told her that, when I said goodbye, when I was leaving, with tears running, she said, "Just promise me you won't go to a pizza shop." I didn't keep that promise, but anyway, so. All right, but Israel's style is very much to very quickly clean up. We don't have the broadcast. Oh, you're working on it? What happened? Lost it completely? Get it going again? Do you need me to find? Yeah, it's on the computer. Just got to connect it to that. Okay. All right. Is that so? So one difference between Columbine and Newtown is that it's high school elementary. Any other thoughts? What might else explore? Or is there one correct, one wrong? Yeah, go ahead. Right. Okay, so the fact that they're memorializing, so they are showing that action. So why couldn't Newtown do the same thing? Huh? So they couldn't. So maybe you're saying, and in fact I will tell you that from a purely, let's say, literature point of view, Columbine makes more sense. Because the style with trauma is you have to go back to the traumatic situation and deal with it and work on it. Right. So they return to the same building, but with a different attitude, and you know, with taking over, taking, what do they call it? I think taking up, conquering Columbine. Right. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
Yes. We have Mr. Holocaust survivors. We don't want to be forgotten. So when you rebuild the place and you moralize in the place, you're not forgetting. You're holding on to something.
Okay. You're not making believe like it's not there. It's commemorate. Yeah, a very important part is commemoration. Is to be able to, you're not able to get it up anymore? It's coming. Okay. All right. Commemorate. That's true. In fact, it's very interesting that you mentioned Holocaust survivors. How many people here are either the child or grandchild of a Holocaust survivor? Okay. A good number of us. Okay. For how many of you did that parent or grandparent speak with regularity about what they went through? Okay. A handful. How many hardly ever spoke about it? Who's right? Oh, why is everybody right? Very important. Here we go. That there are, okay, thank you. Thank you, Zaman. There are some very, it's a highly individual experience. Dave Pelkovitz likes to talk about attenders and distractors. There are some people that cope with trauma by delving into it. There's some people that cope with trauma by avoiding it. Anyone's a physician will tell you. Some patients, if you're doing a procedure, they Google it, and they come in, they say, why aren't you doing it this way, that way? Others say, doc, do whatever you want, I don't want to know. And they're right for themselves. So could it be that Newtown is doing what's right for Newtown, and Columbine did what's right for Columbine? Newtown, I happen to know a little something about Newtown. I grew up, my parents had a country home in Danbury, which is right next to Newtown. We used to go to the movies in Newtown. Anyway, but so I know Newtown, and I spent three months in Denver, but in a program where we went to different parts of the Colorado community. It was a program, mental health sponsored by the government. When I was in college, I went there. And they're very different kind of towns. Newtown's a sheepish, kind of old-style New England community. Columbine, or Colorado in general, are Westerners, are more tough, most of them owning guns, etc. So there's a different cultural difference. So therefore, it's altogether possible that Newtown did what was right for Newtown, and Columbine did what was right for Columbine. And, yeah,
You were saying, as mentioned before, that people can be broken individuals, so
Mm-hmm. Or you have to trust the intuition, because when somebody is grieving or traumatized, it's almost like, you know, the adrenaline rush you get when if you're in danger. So everything like rushes to your limbs and you can do physical things you couldn't do otherwise. The same thing is true with trauma or grief. You have an immediate, people think that people who are bereaved or traumatized become stupid. And in some respects that's true. They may not remember that new recipe for Lachsenkugel when their house is being flooded. But intuitively know what they have to do to survive. And intuitively know what they have to do to survive emotionally. I can't tell you how many times in the work that I've done over these, I mean, I'm in the field over 30 years, and a lot of the time doing work in trauma and grief, and that somebody would present to me a coping mechanism that at the moment made no sense. But as I delved into it further, and as I got to know them as an individual, it made perfect sense for them. So that's, I think, one of the lessons, and it's even more powerful when we include all the other schools, because you can see the breadth of response. One of the schools was an Amish school, you know, so you can see the breadth of responses, and I guess we'd have to think about that. God forbid, if anything like this would happen, I'm sure our community would respond in its own individual way. Okay, Now I'm getting to cutting edge, and if we need more time, how are we doing? Huh? Okay? Okay. This is cutting edge now. What will be, or what can we anticipate, is going to be the nature of the trauma for our children most recently and maybe for times to come? And there's a term that was coined by Howard Blum. Howard Blum is a best-selling author and a very famous reporter for the New York Times. And he wrote a piece called Generation Lockdown. I put down food for thought. I have here a summarized version. I could not say it as well as him. So we're going to read through that. And then if you need more time, we'll take some questions or there are other subjects that I didn't include because I want to stay within the time constraints. But here's Howard Blum's description of our children, or grandchildren's generation. What will be the nature of their trauma? My sons and daughters are coming of age under the shadows of Sandy Hook and the Boston Marathon bombing. They are children of Generation Lockdown. The iconic image of the time in which they live is two brothers, lethal, detached, and determined, weaving their way through the oblivious crowd like a malware virus smuggled into the machinery of daily life. They were the children of the generation nurtured by visions of Maurice Sendak and J.K. Rowling, but now they have grown up to discover that they are living in a land where wild things truly roam. Only there are no boy wizards waving magic wands to protect them. Their saviors are black outfitted SWAT teams and the heavily armored warriors who drive rumbling armored vehicles through the city streets or fly helicopters whose infrared signs can reveal all that is hidden. Theirs is a time when the long missing weapons of mass destruction will at last be discovered and revealed to be in the backpacks and pressure cookers already lurking in our midst. When the words of the prophets will be written on Facebook walls and then hacked in the name of public safety. When the great cities will be shut down and people will take refuge in their homes, comforted by the bright electronic glow of their social media devices, just as their ancestors were warmed by the fires in their caves. It is not the end of history, but it's a new grim beginning. And that's what I think we're facing today and what our children are facing. And just in closing, he says, you want the sign that reads, the world ends tomorrow, when do you have to have it? Okay, thank you very much. Should we take questions or, huh? Okay. I mean, unless there's other subjects I can go into, but if there, no? Okay. All right. So let's take questions then, sure.
Careful. Okay. So, as we say, Baruch Hashem for New York traffic, Robertson Feiner is about 3 minutes to 3 minutes away, right, Chandy? She's been keeping track. And I would like to open it up to both speakers, if you've got any questions, while we are serving dessert. And straight afterwards, our guest speaker will be Robertson Feiner. So any questions? Right. The question is, so everybody can hear, why is it called Generation Lockdown? Can you just go into that explanation?
The reason is that with homegrown terrorism and with this, the threat not coming from, in the past, primarily threats came from outside the environs of your community, outside your state, your city, etc. Now the threat is coming from within. And what we are training our children to do is to have lockdown drills. In fact, last year I was interviewed for Bina Magazine by reporter Shoshana Bernstein, who's taking this on very much as a sort of cause celebre, about the necessity for camps to have lockdown drills, because what would be an easier place for an intruder to get in? But it is, and by the way, I'm pretty sure they are, but all of your schools should have lockdown drills now, because this is a new mitzvah, this is a new reality. If you're interested, I, together with the school partnership at YU, we put down some guidelines of how to have lockdown drills. If your school has not had them yet and wants our assistance, please contact me. We'd be more than happy to provide that for you, because there's a methodology how to have lockdown drills. But schools today, and by the way, Sandy Hook and Columbine had lockdown drills. They had procedures, what to do in the case of an intruder, and most experts say it saved hundreds of lives. So this is the, but this is the world that children live in today. They live in the world where the threat, I'm sorry? Lockdown drill means that there's a certain, let's say, message, or actually better, more likely like a drill, I mean like a, some sort of alarm, and the children, like a fire drill, it's really a replication of the fire drill. Basically what the children do is, first of all, the recommendation is that teachers should be provided, a classroom should be able to be locked, and teachers should have access either to the code to open up the lock or the key to unlock the door. That windows in classrooms today should be double thick glass windows, so they cannot be, or those windows with the metal inside of them, so they cannot be easily broken. And the children, there should be a part of the classroom where the children should be able to go where they're least accessible from the window. I'm sorry. And these are, and most schools, by the way, today, at least that I'm familiar with, have had lockdown drills. And by the way, it's very important, and again, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I think we're stalling a little bit. Children are capable. All right, I'm okay? All right. Children are capable. Here's an important thing. We're worried about traumatizing children. If a drill like this is done correctly, children are capable of compartmentalizing an awareness of danger without experiencing the prevailing world as dangerous. They do it with fire drills. We do it with teaching safety in terms of molestation. And okay, go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry, you do that. Okay, I'm going back to my seat. I'm going back to my eggplant.
I kicked him up. Yes, go ahead.
I don't know if this is the place for it, but the lockdown drills I've had, I've run, but what is really the best thing to say to a three-year-old?
Well, I'm going to repeat the question, okay?
If the relatives don't mind.
No, please. Let me. So the question is, what do you say to a 3, 4, 5 year old about why a lockdown drill is happening? And I'm going
to.
And why they need to be quiet.
So when we explain things to children in a way that they can understand according to their age level, it's very helpful to them. It gives them a sense of security. Someone was asking me earlier, you know, how do we talk about a Leby-Kletsky type thing to kids? When we explain things on their age level in a way that their little brains can absorb, it's helpful for them. They own it. They can absorb it. So to say to a child that there are things, you know, there are people in certain parts of the world that do things that they're not supposed to, you know. Again, to explain that this is very, I mean, three-year-olds don't understand rare and unusual, but to use words that they can understand. You know, and this is a practice. You know, this is like when we play dress-up. You know, bring it to a place where they understand. When we play dress-up, you know, we pretend that we are a fireman, and we pretend that we are a policeman. So we are playing, we are acting out dress up, we are acting out a situation, you know, that's a play. But this is, again, to bring it to their level. To be careful, though, because with preschool age kids, when you say to them something might happen, it's going to happen. Okay, school age kids more can absorb that. But when I tell my preschool age kids that we're going to Israel in the summer, it's, you know, 6 months away, for 6 months every day, are we going, are we going, are we going? So not to say, you know, this is in case something happens, or this is, you know, sometimes things happen, but to bring it more to a preschool level. We're playing dress up, we're playing play, you know, not to, again, not to say that something might happen, but rather, we are playing. Let's play, pretend. School age kids, okay?
Shades are closed,
Okay, so...
I'm going to say similar but a little different. Let me ask a question, okay? Three-year-olds have fire drills. They understand fire, that the school could be on fire?
Yeah.
What makes the three-year-old go along with a fire drill?
Because in case, if you're telling him exactly that in case there's a fire, you have to know how to get out of the building.
Right. Oh, so do you think the three-year-old is thinking about a fire? Yeah, it's fine. Well, it is fun. That's true. It is fun. Right, I know. My problem was, back when I was a kid, we used to have, again, I'm aging myself, we used to have some of these drills in case the Russians bombed us. So one of them was to go under a desk. A lot of good that would have done. But one of them was that we'd have to run home. The bell would go off. I went to public school until fourth grade. So the bell would go off and we'd have to run home. I liked that drill so much I started doing it every day. But seriously, the little kid, the younger child, and I think that's sort of what Zahava was saying, the younger child does what the adult tells him. And just in a robotic kind of way does it. They're not thinking that much about what this means. This is the kind of drill, this is what we do, and they robotically find. Now, one of the recommendations we came up with when we did these recommendations, the YU School Partnership, was for the older kids, the first drill is anticipated. The first drill, they're told ahead of time what's going to happen, exactly the time that it'll happen, so they can go through it, and then the subsequent ones come as a surprise.
With the preschool age kids, the key is the teachers. If you empower the teachers to give over the rules, the guidelines, the process in a very safe, secure, loving way, then you have no issue. You know, it's when their faces show anxiety, when their voice is shaking, then the preschool age kids know that there's something to worry about.
Okay. I see Robertson Feiner just walked in, Baruch Hashem. Any other questions for either of our speakers? No? I'll repeat whatever's been said. The comment was that Rabbi Aaron Reich, when they did Beis Yaakov Borough Park, did not let anybody out. He told the parents there's no information till. Right. He owned the problem and he owned the condition. And there was no relinquishing the children. So thank you for that comment. I want to give a huge
chaos
to a huge chaos. They will fix it. Don't worry about it. Just take it down. Leave it down. Okay. You know, we're supposed to learn from everything that happens. I'm trying to work out what to learn from that falling down, but okay. But Robertson Feiner, Shandy Gerwitz, who helped us out in getting Robertson Feiner here, and thank you, Shandy, was speaking to Robertson Feiner on the phone. And as you can imagine, we've got a room full of Robertsons, and we were a little nervous when she stuck in Prospect Park. And Robertson Feiner said to Shandy, she said, "Everything is in the hands of the Eibishter. Everything will work out. And you know what? I think that explains Robertson Finer in one word. It gives me great honor. You ready?
Yeah.
Yes. To invite her to come up and talk to the audience. Thank you.
Birchos Chashev Robertsons, I feel tanak tana me'od, and I am humbled to speak in front of all of you. Bishop's Hush of Professionals as well. I am sorry that I missed the valuable words that you heard. And I'm hoping that despite the fact that I didn't hear them, my words will follow and bolster what you heard professionally, somewhat with a little bit of Hashkafas HaTorah. I share with you my personal tefillah as a Rebbetzin of a huge kehillah. Many things I'm sure were discussed today, and I can tell you honestly that on my last trip to Eretz Yisrael, I stood before the Kosel HaMaravi and I had nothing else to say but Ba'ad Amech Rachvim Shali. There is so much. And yes, so much falls on our shoulders. And we need to be there to offer the words of chizuk and encouragement. And it comes from every single direction. So what is the hashgafa of the Torah? There is a very lofty level, which is certainly not the one that was shared, practically speaking, as to where people are at today. Despite the fact, when I thought to myself on the first note, who is the person in the Torah who responded to trauma? Who is the example? The first one that came to mind was Vayidom Aaron. And I shared that with a professional friend of mine. And in as much as Aaron HaKohen is praised and rewarded, and in fact the Radomsker says that even bigger than Vayidom Aaron is David HaMelech, who says, Leman yizamercha kavod velo yidom. That not only can I stand there silently and not cry in anguish, I will be mizamer kavod to you. There is that level of being able to swallow and serve. In the past year, in my very, very small shul, we lost three young mothers, younger. And two of them were nifteres erev, one on the first night of Sukkot and another one on an erev Rosh Hashanah. And I watched, and I shared, and I sat in those homes where I saw families that were able, leman yizamercha kavod velo yidom. Because it's Yontif, and we cannot be Avil, and we have no halachos of Avilus, and we have the halachos of Simchas Yontif. And I was sitting with teenagers and children. There is that level. Yet, the famous story is told about the Rama, who passed a dayan from his beis din because the dayan lost a son, or a daughter, I'm sorry. He lost a daughter, and the Rama watched him. And he smiled, and he said, I will serve Hashem. Rama said, how could you possibly be a dayan for Klal Yisrael if you do not feel pain? Lo zu haderech for Klal Yisrael. Maybe for Aaron HaKohen? And that doesn't mean he didn't cry inwardly. But where Klal Yisrael is at, what hurts, hurts. And if we don't hurt when we're hurting, we're not human. There is a direct reference to trauma. It's a pasuk in Mishle, at least the best that I could relate to trauma as I was thinking of ideas. And it's a pasuk from Mishle Gimel that we say grouped together after Aleinu. We use this pasuk in conjugation with a number of other psukim that actually come from a medrash based on Megillas Esther, why we put these psukim together. Al tira mipachad pisom. Don't be afraid of sudden fears. Fears that you weren't expecting. Things that you didn't think would happen to you. Ki Hashem tzilcha is how the psukim continue in Mishle. Because Hashem will protect you. The Malbim is of the opinion that pachad pisom is referring to a person whose mind is being tortured by irrational fears. The sky's going to fall down. My house is going to collapse. This is going to go wrong. That is going to go wrong. Al tira mi pachad pisom. However, I saw from the Daso from Harav Rabinovich that he says pachad pisom is a real pachad. And Hashem is trying to give us koach because a pachad pisom is a much more frightening koach. He says because there's a pachad that we could call a pachad matzoi. A pachad matzoi means that I'm aware they predicted a hurricane might be coming. So at least when it came, even though it came with much more strength than we expected, certainly in many of our neighborhoods, the pachad was matzoi. I was able somewhat to prepare if I had the kalim and the wherewithal to do it at the time. A pachad pisom is a much more frightening pachad. It's a trauma. It's the shock that I didn't expect it. I didn't know it was coming. And if I can share with you something very personal, I think it illustrates it even more. I have a child who is 5.5 years old, my Shaila. He is a special needs child. He lives a very happy life of love and simcha. And he doesn't know anything else. And he doesn't understand anything else. So when the doctor smiles at him, he smiles back. And when he gets a shot, he cries and howls 10 times more than the other child who may have walked in, crying already because they knew that in the doctor's office they were going to get a shot. Because to him, the shock of that pain is so much more traumatic because he didn't know that he was going to get it. Shlomo HaMelech says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Al tira mi pachad pisom. Somehow try to prepare yourselves. If you're going to be hit by it, know that Hashem is ksilcha. Know that He'll be there for you. Know that is our hashgafa. Know that Hashem will somehow get you through it. And I share with you the memories of a person who went through major trauma. And Hashem did get me through it. And the more prepared you are to know that Hashem is ksilcha, He is going to cover you, He will save you, He will be there for you. Don't be a ksil, says one of them, Farshan. Don't be a fool. He is ksilcha. But a shock is a shock. And if I can share with you something that Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, which I think is so powerful in the light of some of the topics that were discussed today, he asks a very interesting question on Akedas Yitzchak. He says, why is it that Avram Avinu, who actually went through the whole routine of taking his one and only son, walking with him, carrying the knife, walking up the hill, setting up the Mizbeach, putting the bricks and the sticks to build the Mizbeach, getting ready to light the fire, Avraham Avinu is fine. He walks away of whole mind and body from this incident. And Sarah heard the news that it almost happened but didn't happen, and she dropped dead on the spot. And says Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, that's being prepared for the Nisayon, was Avraham, and Sarah was not being prepared for the Nisayon. That's the difference. She wasn't prepared for the Nisayon. The Nisayon can be so shocking. And like I started with, somehow as Klal Yisrael, we are meant to have the kelim to go from that shock to leman yizamer chakova v'lo yidom, like these families that I sat with on Yontif, who lost their mothers and went into atabech artanu mikola amir ahavto sana ratzisa banu ramam tanu mikola nishanmos mikola lishanos. We're so happy to be yidden. It's great. It's so happy. They went straight into Yontif. There is something so strong in Klal Yisrael. We know that we are human and that we are real. And to be honest with you, I can share with you that if I ever wake up in the night and allow myself to go back to the most traumatic 24 hours of my life, I will feel my heart start to palpitate. I'll start shaking. But I can calm myself down. And before I go to sleep, I ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, V'al yivahaluni rayonai v'chalamos rayim. Please don't let that happen to me. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm holding on to you that you can give me strength. And as people in the position of leadership in Klal Yisrael, we need to be there for those people to give them that strength. Because Hashem, you can light my light up too. Hashem, you can do anything. And I know that, and I'm aware of that, and yet, one of the most powerful messages, give me a second. Don't drink and talk at the same time, right? That I ever heard, that I've recounted and recounted throughout my life, was shared with me by my father from his Rebbe, Rav Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik. And I think it's mentioned by many people. He says, what's expected of us is to look at a Kaddish Baruch Hu's world and say, Hashem, you made such a good world, it's all good. And yet there is one time where we're told, we don't say, like the story of the Rama and the Dayan and his Beis Din, we don't say, good. We don't say, good, when a person has to rise Kriya because they lost one of their dear departed family members. We say, Dayan HaEmes. We say that when we're in that state of trauma, when we're in that state of shock, when a person is moving from the stage of Aninos to the stage of Shiva, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you are Dayan HaEmes. I don't understand you. Nistarim Darchei Hashem. I know there's a Tov and Meitiv, but it is not what is expected. It is not the bracha a Yid makes. Because when it hurts, it's meant to hurt. And somehow, as Klal Yisrael, we grow and we become bigger and better and stronger through that hurt. I read from Avraham Elshor Shlita in his Lekach V'Halibuv the following. He quotes the Svas Emes, who says that the Pasuk says in Devarim Ches, Ki ka'asher yiyaser ish es beno, Hashem Elokecha miyaserecha. Just like a father will give Musar to his son, give Yisurim to his son, punish his son, so too Hashem, your father, Miyasreka, he is giving you Yisurim as well. And the Svas Emes asks a question on the grammar of this statement, on the tense of the word Yiyaser. It is not Ka'asher Niyaser Ish Espino. It is not the present tense of the Hove, like a father rebukes his child. It is Yiyaser, like a father will, future, Asid, like he would give Yisurim to a child. That is how Hashem gives to you. And says the Svas Emes something so beautiful. As parents, we know we're not perfect. And when a parent is miyaser the child, couched in there, which every parent has to try to learn how to control, is their own anger, is their own ego. And parents make mistakes. The parents want to do the right thing, but they're human. Ka'asher yiyaser ish espino. Like a father would, if he knew how to do it perfectly. Kein Hashem Elokecha miyasreka. That's the Svas Emes. That's how Hashem is giving you Yisurim. He knows. He doesn't make mistakes. He doesn't have his own anger. He doesn't have his own ego. He doesn't have his own agenda. This is the emuna of a Jew. I think when I share this of a story that Rabbi Pesach Kron has shared many, many times about how we're told that we are like kekesef biyad hatzoreif. We're like silver in the hands of the silversmith. And how somebody shared with him that they went to a silversmith's shop and they watched and they paid attention as to how the silversmith fashions the silver. And that the silver is very malleable in the heat. And it has to be the exact precise amount of pressure and heat that is applied to the silver in order for the silversmith, the tzoreif, to craft it, to be in the shape that it needs to be. And when they ask the silversmith, how do you know? Too much heat will break it. Too little heat would not get it to the shape that you want it to be. And the answer that Rabbi Kron shared, I think it was on a Tisha B'Av video from the Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation maybe 10, 15 years ago, is that the silversmith said, I know that it's correct when I see my reflection in it. That is the emuna of a Jew. That we know that it is every bit of Yisurim that we get comes from the Eibishter, and so the reverse. I think every week, when I try, Mirtz Hashem, have hatzlacha to daven the tefillos of the day, and I daven mincha. And we talk in the tefillah of mincha about the menucha of a Jew. And we say there, Yakiru banecha v'yedu, ki me'itcha hi menuchasam. Your children should recognize and know that if they have menuchas hanefesh, it comes from you. It comes from their faith in you. V'al menuchasam. And because a yid can have menuchas hanefesh, because I have been in situations in critical care units, and I think to myself, how does a person who doesn't have emunah and bitachon, how do they survive in places like this? In ICUs, if they don't believe, they don't have anything to believe in. V'al menuchasam yakdishu eshemecha. That menuchas hanefesh that we have, because we have it, we should be mekadesh shem shamayim, because we have it. And yet, we're living in a time of tremendous hester panim. When the stories that we hear are nora v'ayom, sorrows that boggle our minds, challenges, as I know you discussed, where we see children facing crises and traumas that we couldn't have fathomed. Not to say we couldn't have fathomed, because we know. We knew the people, and we still know some of the people who walked out of the camps and held their heads up high. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is hiding. And somehow we can't pick ourselves up. I remember, and I don't remember the source, but I remember I heard the following vart in Camp Sternberg as a staff member. So we're talking probably 25 years ago. And it was on Tisha B'Av. And the person shared that the Pasuk says in Shir HaShirim that it says that Kadosh Baruch Hu is mashkiach min hachalonos meitzitz min hacharakim. He's looking out the windows, he's peeking through the cracks. And the person who was speaking then shared, I don't know, b'shem me, that what does Hester Panim mean? Hester Panim is the second half of this Pasuk. It's a child playing in the yard whose mother is watching by the window. And as they're romping around and frolicking, they see mommy in the window and they feel that security. Mashkiach min hachalonos. She's watching. But maybe mommy has a headache. And the sun is giving her a glare. So she closes the blinds. But she certainly does open the crack and check on her child. That's meitzitz min hacharakim. That child does not have the security of seeing mommy right there. We don't have splitting seas and fire and ice. We don't have it. We're living in a time of meitzitz min hacharakim. He's peeking. But we have to believe he's there and trust him. Rav Ramel Shor shares a point not relevant to us, but it's a fantastic point. I want to quote him directly. He says, Chelek Hester Panim Hagadol Shel Dorenu, one of the greatest manifestations of the Hester Panim that we live with today, Shehabanim Es Avoseihem Einam Rotzim B'Tovosam U'Ma'abidim Es HaKesher. That children don't want their parents, they lose the connection, and they don't trust them. That is a manifestation of the Hester Panim that Klal Yisrael is living with. That we don't trust that our Avinu Shebashamayim is Meitzitz Min HaCharakim, that he's watching us, that he knows. That I can tell you that of the times that my son, and he should be nishmar from ever having to be there again, but was in the ICU, I would hang one pasuk above his bed. And it was, Hinei lo yanum v'lo yishan, Shomer Yisrael. The Shomer of Klal Yisrael. He is never, ever going to sleep. And the more he is masked here, the more we have to search for him. And the more bizarre the tsaros seem to be, the more we must be aware that there is an all-knowing, creative Kadosh Baruch Hu who is mashkiach on us. Bizarre, strange, out of ordinary, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling us, I am in control, not out of control. I know what I'm doing. Only an all-knowing Avishter could do something like this. I'm going to close with something that he quotes from the Kedushas Levi. Says Yaakov Avinu said to Kadosh Baruch Hu, "Vata Amarta Heitiv Eitiv Imach." I'm sorry, to Lavan. He says, "You said you were. I was going to be very, very good to you. Heitiv Eitiv." He says, "What's Heitiv Eitiv? I will be very, very good. Why the double lush on there?" He says, "There is a tov that is nira. There is being meitiv to somebody." But sometimes we can be meitiv and it doesn't feel so good. To be heitev eitiv, to say I'm going to make it doubly good, means it's the good that we know is good. And those are the two options of the chesed of Hashem. Yet when it is only the good without knowing that it's good, we have to be mamin in the hester panim because we can't see it. But as Yeshaya HaNavi, whose time of year we are rapidly approaching, as we mourn the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash and the destruction of Tzion, he says, "V'ayin v'ayin, with both of our eyes, we will see Bishuv Hashem Tzion." It should be b'mheirav yameinu that we should see it with both our eyes. The tov, the heitiv, the meitiv, it should only be good. Hu heitiv, hu meitiv, hu yeitiv lanu. Thank you.
I just, better late than never, I just really wanted to, for those of you who don't know who Rebbetzin Feiner is, she's the Rebbetzin of the White Shul, a very large shul in Far Rockaway, and she's also the Menal Helles, the founder, director, Mahon Basi Rachel. And I also just want to add that during the time of the Hurricane Sandy, so not only did the Feiner's house personally lose electricity, many of the families in their shul lost electricity, had extensive damage, the shul itself lost electricity, but yet Rabbi Rebbetzin Feiner and their kehila were a bastion of strength and of chesed that really kept the community going. And in general, Rabbi and Rebbetzin Feiner are a tremendous, tremendous, powerful couple in the community who give us not only Torah and Hashkafa, but love and warmth and attention. On behalf of the task force, I invite you to look through the folders that are on your chairs that have brochures from many of the representative agencies, as well as the CD with many of the topics that we spoke about today and topics that we didn't get to today. And we thank you so much for coming. We wish you bracha, hanatzlacha, and emir tasham. Again, the topics discussed today are all theoretical, and we should share much simcha. Thank you.